This is Wide Margins Episode 2, Nitrate Disintegration. I guess I'll start by explaining the title. It's a bit unusual for a title. In referring to nitrate disintegration, I'm talking about the old film stock that was used in the early part of the 20th century. A lot of people don't realize that the film stock they used in the early part of the 20th century is different from what they use now. Well, in fact, nowadays everything's done digitally, but film stock has gone through some evolutions prior to the digital age, and the reason for it is the original film stock that was used was highly flammable. Now, what this was nitrate film, and it originated as cellulose that was treated with nitric acid. Now, the stronger form of this was called gun cotton, which, you know, ought to tell you something. It's the way we make flash paper, but it's also the way that this early film was made. They would treat cellulose with nitric acid, and it would make, you know, a plastic that you could use for film, but the problem was it was highly flammable. This stuff was flammable at slightly over 100 degrees Fahrenheit. So if you've got it stored in a nice warm attic somewhere in a summer day in Alabama, in a spring day in Alabama, it's gonna spontaneously combust and burn your house down. In fact, that's happened in numerous places where nitrate film has been stored. It's very difficult to store, and it has to be stored, we have learned, in cooler temperatures. This is the reason why most of the films from the early part of the 20th century have been lost, because this stuff is so unstable. And not only is it flammable, but it decomposes pretty quickly, pretty easily, so it doesn't store very well. And really, really old film, say 100 years old, just doesn't look good today. Film restorers are very frustrated with trying to get their hands on this stuff, but also make it viewable. Now, one who has decided to embrace the nitrate disintegration is a filmmaker named Bill Morrison. He makes mostly shorts, and he uses the disintegration of the nitrate film to his advantage. It actually adds to the themes of the films that he decides to restore. And restore is really not the right word for it, because it's not a restoration. When you look at one of Bill Morrison's works, you're not looking at what the original viewers saw. You're looking at something entirely different, an entirely different piece of art. It's like he uses the disintegration to draw out the original themes of the film, or maybe new themes that the original filmmaker never even had in mind. It's amazing how this works, and there's no telling how many times Morrison has tried and failed to get the kind of results that he has had in the few successes that he has had. It's kind of like the way that form helps poetry. You know, the form of a poem, maybe it's written in iambic pentameter, or it's written in some kind of other poetic form. The form is a part of the poem just as much as the individual words or the rhyming scheme or whatever. And the form helps the poem make its point or set the mood, whatever the purpose of the poem is. In that same way, the bubbles and the scratches and the odd amoeba-like shapes on these films of Bill Morrison, the nitrate disintegration, they eerily change the original into something different, but something that is really special, some new kind of art. It's not a restoration, it's something more. Now, why do I bring up nitrate disintegration in Wide Margins? What does it have to do with the purposes of this podcast? Well, to me, just as that nitrate film is not restored, but it's made into something more, when we as Christians are converted, our souls are redeemed, but the world we live in and the bodies that we inhabit are not fully restored, not restored at all, but something more is made of all of this. And that is a point that is driven home by Paul in Romans chapter 8. Now, when you get to Romans 8, you're in the larger context of a discussion of the justification by faith that's in Christ Jesus. And beginning in chapter 5, Paul has started listing some of the blessings of justification by faith. When he gets to chapter 8, he wants to talk about meaning and purpose in suffering in the life of Christians. Christians aren't exempt from trials. They have to suffer just like everybody else. The difference is that they understand why they suffer and there's purpose in that suffering. He's hinted at this earlier in chapter 5, verse 12, where he says, "Therefore, just as sin came into the world through one man, and death through sin, and so death spread to all men because all sinned. Because of sin, death came into the world." And of course, he's thinking here of Genesis 3, which I want to get to in just a moment because it's very important to everything that Paul is saying here in the latter part of Romans chapter 8. But first, let's get to this discussion of suffering. Start at the top of it, which starts at Romans 8, verse 18, where he says, to begin all of this off, he says, "I consider that the sufferings of this present time are not worth comparing with the glory that is to be revealed in us." So he's basically saying, suffering as a Christian in this world is worth it. It's worth it because of what we're looking forward to. There's a glory that's going to be revealed to us in the end that we can wait for. We can make it to the light at the end of the tunnel because of what's awaiting us there. And he starts talking about the world we live in and you know, why we are in the shape we are in. And he starts in a place that might be really interesting to a lot of people. You might not expect him to go this broadly with it. But he starts with the created order. You know, he backs up and he not only talks about human beings, but the entire universe and all the problems that it is suffering. And he says in verse 19, "For the creation," see, he's talking about the natural world there, "the creation with eager longing for the revealing of the sons of God. For the creation was subjected to futility, not willingly, but because of him who subjected it, in hope that the creation itself will be set free from its bondage to corruption and obtain the freedom of the glory of the children of God. For we know that the whole creation has been groaning together in the pains of childbirth until now." Now, some people have a problem with the interpretation that I'm giving here, that, you know, Paul is talking about the universe, because they struggle with the idea of, you know, trees and rocks and monkeys and dogs groaning in suffering. But if you'll stay with me, you'll see that it's a biblical idea for us to think of creation as being in some kind of pain, as being under a curse. And this goes all the way back to the beginning, Genesis chapter 3, when the first sin was committed by Adam and Eve. And I'm assuming you know the backstory here, that God put this tree in the Garden of Eden, the tree of the knowledge, the tree of the fruit of the knowledge of good and evil. I always have trouble with the name of that tree. But he put that in there and he told them, "Do not eat the fruit of the tree. In the day that you eat thereof, you shall surely die." And the serpent comes along and says, "You shall not surely die." And so Adam and Eve believe the serpent over God, and they take the fruit and they eat it, and it changes them permanently. It changes the world that they are in permanently. God told them what would happen. They didn't believe him, and it happened. And he explains this in the words to first Eve and then Adam that are recorded in Genesis chapter 3, beginning in verse 16. Now, here's what he says to the woman: "I will surely Multiply your pain in childbearing. In pain you shall bring forth children. Your desire shall be for your husband, and he shall rule over you. And then listen to what he says to Adam next. Verse 17. Because you have listened to the voice of your wife, and have eaten of the tree of which I commanded you, you shall not eat of it. Cursed is the ground because of you, and in pain you shall eat of it all the days of your life. Thorns and thistles it shall bring forth for you, and you shall eat the plants of the field. By the sweat of your face you shall eat bread, till you return to the ground, for out of it you were taken, for you are dust, and to dust you shall return. Now, if this is a curse, it means that the world he's describing here is different from the world originally created. And you'll remember back in Genesis 1, when God finished creation, he looked at it and he saw that it was very good. And the things that he's describing here are not very good, not good at all. And he gives some examples of the differences, although this is not by any means a comprehensive list. Back up to verse 16 with Eve, women are going to bear children with great pain. And any woman who has given birth to a child can attest to that. I've heard that many times, and I've heard that men, cannot possibly understand. Not even guys, those of you who've had kidney stones, we just don't know how painful it is. It's the most painful thing, I'm told, in all the earth, okay? So that is one thing that changed, and that's a good example because of how painful it really is. He gives some examples to Adam. He says that the ground is going to become cursed. Now, the ground cursed is pretty much the same as saying the world, the earth, is cursed. The natural order is cursed. And it seems that while Adam was a tiller of the ground prior to this, he was a farmer. That was his work that he was given to do in the garden. It was work that came naturally to him, that was done with joy and with ease, you might say. Whereas from this point forward, it was going to be toilsome and it was going to be drudgery. It wasn't going to be fun at all. There were going to be thorns and thistles where there used to not be thorns and thistles. And he's going to have to eat by the sweat of his face. And eventually he would die, which was not the original plan. So now the man God formed out of dust has to return to dust, not the original plan. We were talking about this verse in Bible class at Asheville Road, where I preach, just the other night, and started going with it and talking about, maybe this explains mosquitoes. I've always wondered, why in the world did God make mosquitoes? And yellow jackets. Yellow jackets are the worst. I don't know if you've ever been stung by one of those, but those are bad guys. You don't want to be hit by a yellow jacket or a wasp, and there are all kinds of ugly things in this world, and the natural world is a very dangerous place for mankind. But it didn't seem that way for Adam and Eve in the beginning. They didn't seem to be in danger when they were surrounded by creation. So, I believe that when God created the world, he created all of the DNA necessary for the variety, the diversity of life that we see today. But maybe that life, I'm not talking about, macro evolution here. I want to be clear. I'm not talking about, new families of animals. But we know that the animal kingdom does adapt. We know the plant kingdom adapts. And maybe, this is an oversimplification, but maybe bees didn't have stingers prior to this, and they adapted stingers. Maybe the plants that now have thorns were thornless. Maybe the original watermelons didn't have seeds, Maybe the original watermelons were seedless and a lot easier to eat. Of course, then how would they be reproduced? But, you know, I'm joking here, and I guess this isn't a very funny thing to joke about, but I'm trying to get across the point that the world God originally created changed when sin entered the picture. And the world would change again. Over in 2 Peter chapter 3, Peter talks about the current world compared to the world before the flood. And speaking of the world before the flood, he calls it the world that then existed, as if it no longer exists. So in those terms, you could think of at least three different worlds. You have the Eden world, the paradise, the good world. And then after sin, you have the cursed world, which becomes even more cursed after the flood, which changed the world again. So we live in a very different world today than was originally created, and that introduces the possibility of the groaning that Paul is talking about in Romans chapter 8. So if you want to go back to Romans 8, I want to finish the argument that Paul is making here about suffering and about how it has meaning and purpose and how that works in with... Oh, by the way, I wanted to raise this question. So we're talking about the disintegration of physical things, right? You know, thorns and thistles and, you know, death. All of those things are physical. Some, in fact, many have the belief that also on this occasion, when the world fell, that's theological language for what happened here, the fallen world, when the world fell, it wasn't just the physical things that fell, but also the very souls of mankind fell. And this is where we get our sinful nature. So is that a true doctrine? Did we develop a sinful nature in Genesis 3, whereas before Genesis 3, we didn't have that sinful nature? Well, the biggest problem with that argument is that sin is what created this whole situation. So, you know, Adam and Eve were fully capable of sinning prior to the curse. So in the form God created them, he made them in his own image, meaning they had the ability to choose their way in life. They could sin, and the sin is what brought all this on them. Not only that, but Paul is assuming we've read this whole letter up to this point. And in Romans chapter 7, he says something about, you know, whether or not our souls were affected the same way that the whole created order was affected. And I'm thinking about Romans chapter 7, verse 9. Now listen to this. It's pretty deep, but if you think about it, the logic is clear. He says, I was once alive apart from the law, but when the commandment came, sin came alive and I died. This is a part of his explanation that without law, you can't have sin. Because as John says, 1 John 3:4, sin is transgression of the law, or sin is lawlessness. So the law creates boundaries. Crossing those boundaries amounts to sin. So Paul's saying there was a time when I was alive, and then law came into my life. In other words, I grew to the point of maturity that I understood the difference between right and wrong. I understood law. And then when that commandment came, sin came alive in himself. In other words, he committed sin because he reached the age of accountability, and he died. Now, obviously, he didn't die physically because he's writing these words. He died spiritually. So if we're born with a sinful nature, if sin is inherited, if we're teaching the doctrine of original sin, the question, according to Romans chapter 7, verse 9, is when could Paul have been spiritually alive prior to his spiritual death? I mean, it sounds like he's saying, I was born innocent, I was alive spiritually, And then I grew to the point of maturity that law came into my mind. I knew the difference between right and wrong. And then I died spiritually. That's a very different picture than the one given to us by the doctrine of original sin. So the Bible doesn't teach this. I understand there's a lot of people who believe it, but that's not a part of what fell. I believe that our souls are intact when we're born. We choose to sin, and that's how we are included alongside of Adam and Eve in those that die spiritually. All have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. Romans 3:23 tells us all sinned, Romans 5:12, but it's not because we didn't have a choice. We had the choice, just as Adam and Eve had the choice. And so we also follow their footsteps into death. And we live in this world, though, that sin created for us, this physically corrupted world. But you'll notice in verse 23 a promise. He says, not only the creation, but we ourselves, talking about Christians, who have the first fruits of the Spirit, groan inwardly as we wait eagerly for adoption as sons, the redemption of our bodies. Christians talk a lot about the redemption of our souls, but here Paul is talking about the redemption also of the body, the physical, the resurrection, the day at the end of time when God puts all of this back together again and introduces a new heaven and a new earth. The old world, the old order, the corrupted order will be burned up and completely destroyed, according to 2 Peter 3:10. And this new heaven and new earth, this new universe, will be built the way that it originally was supposed to be. And we will have these new, glorious, incorruptible, imperishable bodies, and everything will be put right again. Now that redemption is our hope, which Paul goes on to describe in verse 24 and 25. He says, in this hope we were saved. Now hope that is seen is not hope, for who hopes for what he sees? But if we hope for what we do not see, we wait for it with patience. So the hope here means that for the Christian with this hope, life has meaning. We understand why the world is the way that it is, and we understand where it is going, and we have a bright future in that picture of the world that is given to us by the Spirit and the Word. In the meantime, the Spirit helps us, verse 26 says, in our weakness when we don't know what to pray for as we ought, he intercedes for us with groanings too deep for words. Meaning he intercedes to the Father on our behalf for our needs when in this intense suffering we don't really know what to ask for, but we know where we're headed and God is going to make all things right in the end. Now this all comes to a climax, I believe, in verse 28 where Paul says, and we know that for those who love God, all things work together for good for those who are called according to his purpose. When he says all things, he's talking about all the disintegration, all the corruption, all the pain in this world, and all the good things in this world. God works all of those things together for good, for those who love God, for those who are the called according to his purpose. So life may be disintegrated, it may be burned, it may be pockmarked, scarred, limping and wounded, bruised, damaged. But somehow God takes that and he takes all of the good things and he's able to work those together for good. I want to go back to Bill Morrison, who I talked about at the beginning of the podcast. There's a film of his that I love called The Mesmerist, which I think if you watch the film, it's clear he's talking about a hypnotist. Now, the film opens up with a sleeping man played by Lionel Barrymore. If you don't know who Lionel Barrymore is, you probably saw him. He's the crotchety old man in It's a Wonderful Life. Most people know him from that and only that, but He was actually a very good actor from the silent film era. And in this movie, you see him waking up at the very beginning of the film. And then somehow, we're not sure how, he's transported to a fair. And he encounters this mesmerist or hypnotist played by a younger Boris Karloff. Boris Karloff is somebody you know from some of the B-monster movies. He played Dracula or somebody. I don't know, but he's very good. He's very weird. Very good in this movie as the hypnotist. And he spots Barrymore out in the crowd for some reason. And he says to him, "I can put you in a trance in which you will tell us anything you have ever done." Now, Barrymore doesn't really seem to want to make this deal with him, but Karloff's character proceeds anyway. So he puts Barrymore under this trance, and then we're transported to another place, a much darker scene on a snowy night, and Barrymore's character encounters this very wealthy man whom he kills for his money, steals the money, and then gets away with it somehow. This was his big secret. And he comes to out of this trance back at the fair, and it seems that everybody now knows the biggest secret in his life, and he just wants to get out of there. So he gets out of there, and then in another scene, he's at his table, we assume at home, and the ghost of the man that he murdered appears to him. And he doesn't seem angry or upset. He's just there, and he's just kind of waiting for Barrymore to react. And finally, Barrymore's character says, "I have repented. My sin has been forgiven." To which the ghost only says, "Then peace be with you." And then he kind of fades back out. And so the viewer is sitting there, and Barrymore's character also, wondering, what does that mean? The ghost didn't say, I forgive you, or you have been forgiven. He's just saying, well, if that's your story, then be at peace. But Barrymore looks far from peace. You can see on his face, he is very troubled and will be haunted by this murder for the rest of his life. And then, is when you think the film is over, he wakes up again. So it's like he could have dreamed the whole thing. He could have dreamed the fair, being hypnotized. He could have dreamed the murder. Or maybe he dreamed the fair and the ghost, but he actually committed the murder, and it's on his subconscious all the time. You don't know. You don't know at first whether or not he's forgiven, and then you don't know if any of this really happened, or if it happened and he dreamed some of it. You're just left in this ambivalence. And throughout all of this, the form of the film is constantly going back and forth between, you know, crystal clear picture to this bubbly, cracked, burned, sometimes indecipherable view of life where, you know, it's everything's twisted and crooked. And the reason I like what Bill Morrison does with film, with this old Nitrate film, is because it represents real life so well. It takes these old movies that are very imaginative and have a lot of fantasy, and then the very form of it, instead of trying to restore them, which is impossible, he just lets them sit there as a testimony to the way life really is. You know, we're all here in this cracked, bubbly, burned, scorched, cursed world trying to figure things out. And all of us, unbelievers and believers, Christians and non-Christians, are experiencing the same thing. The only difference is Christians have faith in the Word of God, which says there is meaning in all of this. You can have hope because there's meaning in this. First of all, there's a reason why the world is the way that it is. There's a reason for suffering, and that's that sin brought suffering into the world. This pain and trials we're going through are the natural consequences of sin. But secondly, there's a purpose in suffering. Life has meaning. We're all headed somewhere. This is all going somewhere, and for the Christian, it's going in a very bright direction. So all of the pain and suffering that we're going through is worth it all, because at the end, glory awaits us. And that's all I have for this episode on nitrate disintegration. Thanks for joining us. See you next time.